you know, it is a broadly popular thing when you talk to folks about progressive financing, and you don't use big buzzwords like redistribution or progressive financing, right? You talk about people paying their fair share, and Medicare for All would do that.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof.
I feel like COVID has shed a spotlight on the American healthcare system in a lot of ways, and one of the most heavily debated policies out there has been the notion of Medicare for All. But how well is it understood, really? What has COVID revealed about our current healthcare system? And can Medicare for All still happen in the Biden administration? And if not, when? To answer these questions, I wanted to turn to two people intimately familiar with the topic, Dr. Abdul El Sayed and Dr. Micah Johnson, the authors of Medicare for All, A Citizen's Guide. Dr. El Sayed is the former Detroit Health Commissioner, a progressive activist, and CNN commentator. Dr. Johnson is a Boston-based physician, healthcare researcher, and policy advisor. This is a fascinating conversation, so let's just jump right in. So, Abdul and Micah, welcome to Future Proof.
Thank you so much for having us.
I know I have a lot of this in the intro, but in a nutshell, who are you both and what do you both do on a day-to-day basis?
So my name is Micah Johnson. I'm a doctor. I'm doing my training in internal medicine. So the vast majority of my time I spend taking care of patients in the hospital or in primary care clinic. And then I work in health policy, doing research and writing and working directly with policymakers on ways to try to make the healthcare system work better.
My name is Abdul El Sayed. I'm a physician and epidemiologist. I don't see patients on the day-to-day and spend most of my time focused on public communication with respect to, right now, the COVID-19 pandemic, but issues related to health and healthcare. I host a podcast called America Dissected and write a newsletter called The Incision. And so those are sort of my primary pieces. I also do some teaching at the intersection between health, politics, and policy as well.
I mean, between both of you guys, I don't know where the sleep happens, but, you know, hats off to all the work. That's great.
I sleep for both Micah and I.
So. Yeah. One thing I was really curious about is I feel like the pandemic has, you know, shined a light on a number of inequities and issues with our current healthcare system. And I'm wondering if you could kind of jump into those, you know, from your own perspectives.
Yeah, so our healthcare system was not prepared for the pandemic, and millions of Americans lost their health insurance when they lost their jobs. But what's even worse is that our bodies weren't prepared for the pandemic. And I saw this working with COVID patients in the ICU, where when you have folks who for decades have lacked reliable access to primary care, haven't been able to afford the medications to treat their heart disease or their lung disease, when they get this virus, they're going to be sicker, more likely to be in the hospital, in the ICU, on ventilators, or to die from COVID. And those are because of the inequities in our healthcare system that really set us up for failure and contributed to a lot of the racial and economic inequities, which have been horrible during the course of the pandemic.
The other piece of that is our health system is so focused on curing disease that we don't spend as much time or effort on preventing it. I was the health commissioner for Detroit. I rebuilt that health department back in 2015. And if you look at national public health spending, the fact that Detroit's health department had been shut down is really not as big of an anomaly as you assume it to be. We are in a moment where public health investment has flatlined over the past 10 years. The CDC support, adjusted for inflation, has fallen. And together, that creates the circumstance where we haven't invested in being able to take on these kinds of pandemics. And it's no wonder then, in the context of this once in a century virus, that our health system failed. And what that meant, our public health system failed. And what that meant is that all of those folks who had been vulnerable, as Micah talked about, coupled with our healthcare system, coupled with our incapacity to test and trace and vaccinate at any degree of speed, left us deeply vulnerable and cost us 570,000 lives.
Speaking of that, we're speaking in the middle of April when Michigan's become the center of the latest COVID surge with, I think it was an average of over 7,300 new daily cases last week. And I was wondering, what's the link between that surge and the UK variant of the virus? Because I feel like for the average layperson, it's confusing. Like, oh, there are a lot of people who are vaccinated, but yet the numbers are very doggedly high.
Well, in order for vaccines to have their grand impact on the pandemic, we have to hit what we call herd immunity, meaning epidemiologists agree that we need 75 to 85% of people to have been vaccinated. And the 25, 28% that we have now is nowhere near that. And so even though we have a large proportion of people vaccinated, thankfully, right, it still doesn't put the kind of blanket over the fire of the pandemic as we would hope. And B.1.1.7 is both more transmissible, and there's evidence to suggest also potentially more deadly, although that's less clear given the scientific disagreement on that. But it's certainly more transmissible. And Michigan has been the country's epicenter for per capita B.1.1.7 cases since January. And so what we're seeing here is a combination of B.1.1.7 coupled with the over-optimism about how much vaccine we have on board, like the idea that we have a vaccine is sort of the same thing as people having been vaccinated, and those two things are not the same. And then aggressive reopening by public officials. And you take those things together and you have what is a perfect storm. The sad thing about this, though, is that that's the same ingredients for that perfect storm. They exist everywhere. It's just that Michigan has been the canary in the coal mine because we've had so many more B.1.1.7 cases and a lot longer for B.1.1.7 to spread.
It's I got to say, I think it's interesting when you walk down the streets of Manhattan on a Sunday and you see all the people who are having brunch. And those are all the people who, for the most part, are not yet vaccine eligible. But then there are the people who have been vaccinated who are still at home being very, very cautious, for better or for worse. So it's like this perfect storm of, you know, people just feeling like they're just a little bit fatigued and want to go back to normal without necessarily that being the right thing to do.
You know, that's absolutely right, Jeremy. I'll tell you, I'm fatigued. I want to go back to normal. I think all of us do. And the only way to get there without having to look over our shoulder and be worried about who might get sick is to get our vaccine. And it, until we get to a level where the virus really is behind us, we've got to be cautious. And so, you know, I tell folks, when you get a chance, vax up. But until then, mask up. Even after that, mask up, back up, and wash up. And if we can follow that, I think it makes our lives a bit easier because we're all looking forward to that day when this pandemic is behind us. It's just not here yet. The last thing, the point that you made is a really important one, which is that these people who have denied the vaccine or denied the virus and chosen not to get the vaccine tend to be the same people. And that really is a recipe for disaster, right? It's one thing to say, I'm not going to do the thing that's going to protect me, but I'm going to be cautious otherwise. It's another to say, I'm going to be cautious, but not get the vaccine. But if you're saying, I'm not going to get the vaccine, nor am I going to be cautious, that's bad news bears.
I want to jump into what you guys have written about most recently. I mean, I think that the book, I feel like, is very, very timely. And, you know, first off, I'm just curious, you know, straight on, you know, like, can Medicare for all happen in the Biden administration? I mean, this is obviously something that I feel like there's a lot of lack of understanding about what does Medicare for all really mean, what's in there, and what we can dive into that. But first off, is it going to come to, you know, is it going to become a reality?
So I think we need to look at Medicare for all as a long-term push. And, you know, when we look at how we got Medicare, it was years, decades really, of building support around the idea, doing organizing around the idea to be ready for when the political moment comes. And a lot of the work that's been happening around Medicare for all over the last few years has really strong echoes of what happened before Medicare passed in terms of raising it in the public debate, having it have been one of the primary issues being discussed during the Democratic primaries last year, doing the work inside Congress about having hearings and developing the bills into a lot of detail. And then most importantly, having the public conversation and doing the organizing around it. So, you know, I don't think anyone thinks that we're on the precipice of getting Medicare for all tomorrow. But with that said, I think the strategy is to have all the pieces in place because it's hard to predict when the political window will open. But I think the idea is to be ready when that time does come.
I think what's also interesting to me about that is that this is just my layman's you know, perspective of it, which is that if not now, you know, like given the fact that there are all these inequities that have been laid to bear, you know, over the last year, and yet there's still not the overwhelming consensus that this is a thing that has to happen, that should happen. I mean, and definitely take your point that it is it's a continuum, you know, and you have to push a little bit further for something to happen before it actually happens. But it is interesting that with this, like you said, you know, so many people who've been, you know, affected by the pandemic, and yet still this is not something that's a broad consensus view. So do you think it's a matter of the fact that the healthcare system is so incredibly complicated that, you know, the average person doesn't quite understand even necessarily all the intricacies and how it works? I mean, what are some of the barriers that have to come down in order to make Medicare for All a reality?
Yeah, Jeremy, I appreciate you bringing up that point. Part of why we wrote this book is because we know that healthcare is broken, and that feels like a conversation happening somewhere else. And then we know that we're struggling to be able to afford our own healthcare. And that seems to be a conversation happening at individual tables. And what we wanted to do with this book was sew all those things together. We wanted folks to understand that the brokenness of our healthcare system, the way that the health insurance industry, the hospital industry, the pharmaceutical industry, the medical device industry have leveraged it for their own profits, directly shapes their experiences with failed healthcare, and that they're not alone. And we need, I agree with you, a conversation right now about how we fix our healthcare system, because if not now, then when? We just watched as this pandemic had its way with our healthcare system, took 570,000 lives, left millions more without their livelihoods. And we watched as our healthcare system crumpled in the process, despite the fact that the health insurance industry made billions more than the billions that they were expecting to make in the first place. And so it is about connecting, but it's going to be a matter of organizing. It's going to be a matter of people connecting around this idea and deciding that they're going to do the work of having those conversations with their loved ones, their friends and family members, their neighbors, the people they work with, about healthcare, about why it is it's broken and what it is it's going to take for us to fix it. In the end, you know, the insurance industry is always going to have more money than the folks who want reform. We have a whole chapter in the book called Organizing versus Advertising. And so, yes, they're going to spend a ton of money advertising. They're going to be fear-mongering us about how Medicare for All is going to do all these things that they're already doing, like costing too much or rationing healthcare or eliminating our choice. And the only way that we address that is to be inured to it, right? Is to do that organizing work to build a movement against it that protects us from that disinformation and that empowers us through one another's experiences.
Yeah, it seems to me that there is theoretically a way very, very far off to remove some of the influence of healthcare profiteers, but that's certainly not easy when you're kind of, I guess the best way to describe it is, you know, the Knicks are playing the Pistons and the Knicks are up 27 and there's 10 minutes left. You know, sure, theoretically, the Pistons can win that game. It's going to be a lot harder. And it feels that there's a little bit of an unfair advantage given the current system and given how much money is in the healthcare system and, you know, trying to maintain the status quo.
To be fair, you do mean the Pistons are up 27 points, right?
Historically, I think the Pistons would be up. This year, no comment.
But I think that's exactly right, where the problems of the system are self-reinforcing in this way, where the, for instance, just take the pharmaceutical companies, where they have protections that let them charge incredibly high prices without having the government be able to negotiate. That gives them an incredible amount of money to then reinvest back in our political system to keep things exactly the way that they are. So it's a wicked problem in terms of how to unravel these things, but there are opportunities for sure. And I think one of the debates that we are likely to see in the coming months is really getting serious about drug pricing. And it's a good test. It's a good test of, you know, one of the concepts of Medicare for All, because really the bills that Congress are debating, it's kind of like, let's take the prescription drug piece of Medicare for All and debate it alone, right? Let's have the government negotiate drug prices. And the proposal on the table is not just for people on Medicare, but for all Americans. And I think it's a real test because the public is not conflicted. You know, we've got 80, 90% of the public, including huge majorities of Republican voters who want the government to be able to negotiate down the prices of prescription drugs. So I think it's really a pure test of what the political will is to make a change. And I think there's actually a good chance that it would be successful.
Yeah, I think that, you know, some argue that Medicare for All has the potential to serve as a massive wealth redistribution program to middle and low income families. And, you know, first off, wondering if you guys agree with that, if that's an accurate assessment? And then if so, it strikes me that some of it is all in the messaging. If you can get the messaging right on something like this, then, you know, the sky's the limit. But if the messaging is a little bit off, and in this case, you know, a lot of people see something like redistribution, quote unquote, as being un-American, whether it is or whether or not it is, then you have a bit of a communications problem. It's not necessarily the fact that it's you know, the wrong argument to make, but maybe it just needs to be finessed in the way that it's positioned.
Yeah, to your point, Jeremy, I believe that Medicare for All would make sure that everybody paid their fair share in healthcare. And in that respect, it's because, you know, rather than the system that we have now, which leaves lower income people paying a higher proportion of their income for healthcare, and also more likely to be hit with out-of-pocket costs that could be devastating for their finances over the long term, more exposed to that risk, Medicare for All takes out that risk, and then rather than forcing lower income people to pay so much, it is financed in a much more progressive way, relying on corporations and the rich to pay their fair share. So in that respect, I think, you know, it is a broadly popular thing when you talk to folks about progressive financing, and you don't use big buzzwords like redistribution or progressive financing, right? You talk about people paying their fair share, and Medicare for All would do that. The other important part of this here, though, is that the overall bill is lower, right? Medicare for All controls costs of healthcare in a couple of ways. First, it eliminates the absurdly large overhead that we have in our current healthcare system. And then second, it allows the government to negotiate prices for all of us. We all know what a monopoly is, which is a single seller of a good. And under Medicare for All, the government becomes what's called a monopsony, which is a single buyer of a good, meaning it can dictate the price of pharmaceuticals, to hospital stays, to the aspirin that they give you at a hospital. And all of those things get negotiated on our behalf. So the cost of healthcare not only goes down, but it stops growing at the same pace, which means that we're talking about a smaller price tag in the first place.
So it seems to me, and this is, again, please push back if I'm wrong, that it's become a little bit of a issue in the States to say that we're going to learn from any other country about the way that anything is done, you know, because one of the best things about intellectual curiosity is you believe that you can learn from anybody. And it seems that one of the things that almost makes us Americans is that we're like, how dare you say that we could do anything better? And, you know, you draw comparisons to Northern Europe and people, you know, are almost like, how dare you say that, you know, we can look at another nation, you know, and find a way to do something. Whereas Google looks at Facebook, you know, Facebook looks at Amazon, and they have no qualms about it. So I'm wondering if that's something that just in general, societally, we have to be working on, you know, with our healthcare system and beyond.
I mean, I think in the political arena, there's a lot of truth to that. And I think one of the powerful rhetorical tools that Medicare for All has is that it evokes Medicare. And we don't need to point to other countries to see how this works. We can point to Medicare itself. And folks in health policy know how successful the program has been. It's really the only part of the healthcare system that is both universal and has successfully controlled costs. And one of my favorite studies in healthcare is what happens when people turn 65 on that day and they switch from private insurance to Medicare, what happens? And their healthcare costs go down 30%. Immediately. And that's for exactly the reason Abdul described, which is that Medicare has a power to negotiate the price of care in a way that the hundreds of fragmented insurance companies simply don't have. And people trust Medicare. It's one of the most popular social programs in the history of the country, despite the fact that when it was being debated, you had people, you know, like Ronald Reagan in the 1960s before he was a politician, saying that if Medicare was passed, freedom as we know it in America would be gone. But nevertheless, it's become the most popular, one of our most popular programs. So I think that's one of the tools that Medicare has on its side.
Yeah. And again, I mean, going back to what you guys said before about this being something that's progressive, I mean, there are a lot of policies that we have now that people who are not that progressive are very much in favor of because they've just been baked into the equation for quite a while. So this is one of those things where it sounds like 10 years after you were to have Medicare for All, every, you know, the overall popularity of the program would be likely through the roof, but at the same time, getting it to that point. It's got to be, you know, of course, in a weird way, you know, frustrating knowing that you've got something delicious that yet you can't get your 4.5-year-old to eat. I'm speaking from experience.
As the father of a 3-year-old, yes, it is very, very frustrating. And yet, right, you find different ways of talking about it and different ways of engaging. The hard part about this analogy, right, or this metaphor, is you've got like the Cheetos, right? And you know this is junk food, right? But you know your kid's going to find it anyway, and they're going to try and eat the Cheetos. And you've got this like delicious gourmet meal that is so much better for them and tastes better. And they keep reaching for the Cheetos. And so that's sort of the analogy of our system, is that we've got Cheetos, right? You know whoever makes Cheetos is making a ton of money off those Cheetos, trying to sell your kid on some Cheetos. And you're trying to feed them the good stuff, and they're not eating it. And so, and yet. Keep pushing, right? You keep talking about it. You keep finessing. You keep engaging, right? My wife and I have this whole thing about how delicious the food is, trying to get my daughter to try it. And, you know, we got to keep pushing. And in the end, the nice thing about this analogy is the kid grows up and makes a good decision. And my hope is that as a country, we grow up and make a good decision, eat well, enjoy it, and have the freedom of our choices and the freedom of knowing that we're doing the right thing for ourselves and our country.
Well, I think that's a really great point to end on, even though I'll ask you one quick follow-up question. And can I just say good luck ever having Future Proof being sponsored by Cheetos now. But in all seriousness, you know, obviously you guys are doing a lot of great work with this book. When would you say is the most likely time that you guys will be in front of a packed auditorium for a live podcast recording or a sit down interview, given where we are, you know, the state of the country mid-April?
My hope is that before the end of 2021, I'm optimistic about the fall. I really am. God willing, as we say, inshallah, and we'll see from there.
I'll take it. Well, amen. Thank you guys so much. Best of luck with the tour. The book is great, and appreciate all the great work you guys do.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks again to both Abdul and Micah for making the time. And, you know, I got to be honest, I am so far from a healthcare researcher, but I think that really diving into this gave me a little bit better understanding of the issues. And it is a complex topic, but I think it's really worth diving into. If you'd like what you just heard and this is your first time here, be sure to subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Stitcher, the choice is yours. And if you're a longtime listener, please remember to rate and review Future Proof, as that's the number one way we get the show in front of people just like you. Special thanks this week to associate producers Jason Stack and V. Cortuccio. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.